It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank. Focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We are not trying to be flip about this. It's literally true. Congress really does find itself between a rock and a hard place, as the cost of war spending approaches roughly the same as the price tag for all of the Vietnam War. Lawmakers took up the issue of further funding today. At the same time, Iraqi leaders were warning an early U.S. troop withdrawal could tip their country into all-out civil war. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, supporting America's public transportation systems, working to help reduce greenhouse gases for a better environment at publictransportation.org. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Rizdal. Appreciate you joining us on this ninth day of July, a day a lot of us got back to work after an extended holiday, including Congress. And topping the agenda for the Senate today, a huge defense authorization bill for next year. For the first time, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan will be funded inside a regular Defense Department budget bill. And see if you can get your mind around this. That makes this $650 billion authorization the largest since World War II. As Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports, Democrats will try to use the defense authorization to hasten the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq.
For the time being, Democrats will steer clear of efforts to restrict funding for military operations in Iraq. They'll start their debate with an amendment requiring that soldiers be given more time at home between combat deployments, 3 years for reserve and guard troops. The sponsor, Virginia Democrat Jim Webb, says that'll force a change in strategy.
The availability of our troops should be the main determinant of how our ground operations are being designed, and that is the intent of the amendment.
Meanwhile, the Congressional Research Service calculates the total cost of the war on terror is now just about the same as the war in Vietnam. Military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan are running at $12 billion a month, a 40% increase over last year. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says that puts more pressure on the Bush administration to change policy.
The American people recognize that this war now, with the General Accounting Office saying it's costing $12 billion a month, that the loss of life and limb is significant, that it's really time for us to have the Iraqis take care of their own country.
However, the White House denies reports the president is considering an early pullback of U.S. forces. A preliminary assessment of the troop surge is due this weekend. An administration spokesman, Tony Snow, was pressed by reporters on whether a change of course will be announced.
Don't expect us to lift the veil and have a whole different strategy. We're not going to have a strategy jumping out of the cake.
The Senate debate on the defense authorization bill is expected to take at least 2 weeks. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
What would you define as an essential public servant? Police, firefighters, of course. And lottery workers? Late last night, Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell shut down the state government, putting all non-essential workers on unpaid furlough. It's his response to a budget impasse with the state's legislature. Turns out the lottery and the state's slot machine parlors are considered to be in the same category as law officers and prison workers. Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains.
Today is not your lucky day if you need to renew your Pennsylvania driver's license or if you wanted to visit one of the Keystone State's historic sites. But if you were hoping to try your luck elsewhere, say the state's lottery or slot machines, well, you're free to give it a shot. That's because those two offices are exempt from the shutdown that furloughed more than 20,000 state employees as of midnight last night. So since when are slots and Powerball necessary government functions? Doug Harbaugh is a spokesman for the Pennsylvania Gaming Board, which oversees the state's five casinos.
Well, the casinos themselves are a significant moneymaker to the state. They're pulling in about $1.7 million per day in tax revenues.
And 31 cents of every lottery dollar goes to state programs such as rent rebates and discounted public transportation for the elderly. John Meixel is a professor of public policy at Indiana University. He says there's not a tremendous amount of money at play.
It's not a big ticket item, certainly not on the order of a sales tax or income tax or motor fuel taxes. But at the margin, it's something that states would rather have than not have.
But he says the state may be worried about losing those gambling dollars.
Even if the Department of Revenue folks are not working that particular day.
Meanwhile, state legislators are still wrangling over the budget. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Charge it. The Federal Reserve reports the biggest jump in credit card debt in 6 months. Consumer borrowing rose at an annual rate of 6.4% in May. Overall, U.S. consumer borrowing was up by almost $13 billion. But all the resulting spending is likely to bring encouraging news on Wall Street, and the major indexes rose. We'll take a closer look when we do the numbers. Everyone's got something to say, and the weblog or blog allows anyone with the appropriate software to post commentary on anything from politics to art to their own families. Typically, anything goes, except when it comes to the corporate blog. A Google employee learned that lesson last week after she posted comments on one of Google's blogs critical of Michael Moore's new film Sicko. That brought a gaggle of complaints for Google, which jumped in with an official mea culpa. It highlights a narrow line of do's and don'ts for corporate bloggers. Debbie Weil is author of the Corporate Blogging Book. Thanks for lending your expertise.
Thank you, Bob.
I was about to ask, how big of a mistake did Google's employee make here? But then you wonder, was it the employer, was it Google that made the mistake? Any distinction, really, in the mind of somebody who visits a company's website?
I don't think so. I mean, I think when they see Google all over the blog and it's official, they're not really concerned about who is writing it. They think of it as the Google blog and as Google speaking.
Hearing this, why would I not think it's more trouble than it's worth here? With the potential for all these problems, why would a corporation even want to do this?
Well, there's a number of reasons, but I think one of the major ones, so for example, this would apply to Dell Computer, is to appear open and transparent, you know, appear as if you're a progressive brand and are interested in and willing to have a two-way conversation with your customers.
And in your experience, has it been beneficial for these companies?
Definitely for Dell. They've started a blog just about exactly a year ago, and it's been very successful in terms of opening up and having people have a place to go and ask very specific questions about different kinds of laptops, and then they were able to respond when there were those exploding laptop batteries. I don't know if you remember that last summer, of something that went around on the blogosphere and in mainstream media. So they were able to respond to that and say, oh, yes, you know, we know about that, and we've set up a special website where you can go and see if your laptop is one of those affected.
So damage control is one of the benefits here.
Definitely. It creates a crisis communications channel that's sort of there and ready and open for you if an issue comes up.
But as we've seen with this experience that Google had, the pitfall can be that you can create your own crisis if you're not careful.
Well, what happened with Google is fairly common. It's maybe one of the most common pitfalls, which is that the employee blogging really strayed into personal opinion, if you will, straying into partisan politics, if you will, by suggesting that the healthcare companies reading her blog should take out ads on Google to protest the movie.
But what I hear you saying is that if you're corporate blogging, the red alert light should go off if you see one of your bloggers straying into politics or personal opinion.
That is what I think, and maybe I'm being too conservative here. I mean, I am a blogger myself and active in the blogosphere, but I think there are two topics that corporate blogs should stay away from because they're very combustible and they're divisive, and one is politics and the other is religion.
And I guess one of the benefits of the flexibility of blogging is that when you do make a mistake, you can just turn around and say, oops, sorry.
That's a best practice in corporate blogging, is if you make a mistake, admit it, apologize, do it instantly, and keep going. And, you know, it's really a contact sport. It's not like issuing a press release, and it's not something a lot of companies are used to. But I think more and more of them are getting very excited about this two-way conversation, you know, way of conversing with customers or prospective employees.
Debbie Weil is author of the corporate blogging book, Everything You Need to Know to Get It Right. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So you think you've been ripped off by your broker? As the saying goes, who are you going to call? There really aren't too many places to take your complaint. Most people choose to avoid court by going through what's called mandatory arbitration, taking their cases before one of the industry's two self-regulatory groups, the NASD or the NYSE. But the Securities and Exchange Commission is expected to sign off any day now on a merger of those two. And as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, critics fear the system will soon be stacked even more against investors.
Almost 10 years ago, Ernestine Strobel invested her life savings with Morgan Stanley Dean Witter. This was the late 1990s, and like a lot of investors, Strobel lost a pile of money when the tech bubble burst. When she filed a complaint, an arbitration panel said Morgan Stanley was liable for Strobel's losses, but the panel awarded her just $5,000. She had to pay twice that amount in arbitration fees. Strobel is now in her late 80s and lives outside Austin, Texas. She says she didn't even cash the check.
I didn't want $5,000. I wanted $283,000, and $5,000 is just chicken feed compared to that.
Strobel thinks she would have done better in front of a jury. But like most investors, she signed an agreement when she opened her account to settle any disputes through arbitration. 20 years ago last month, the Supreme Court ruled that those kinds of mandatory arbitration clauses were legal. Attorney Ted Eppenstein represented investors in that case. He says the decision effectively took away the investor's right to sue.
Previously, the investor could do that. There's a constitutional right under the Seventh Amendment to a jury trial. Only the Supreme Court decided in this very close decision, 5-4, that the brokerage firms could have the investor waive that constitutional right.
In other words, wronged investors have only one place to go, the arbitration panel. With the merger of the NASD and NYSE regulation, they'll have just one choice of venue. And then, Eppenstein says, the odds are stacked against them. Most of the three-person panels include at least one industry representative.
You get someone from the very securities industry that you're suing for fraud sitting in as one of the three arbitrators in all but the smallest of cases. But there's no arbitrator who's supporting the investor's point of view.
Critics say the two so-called public arbitrators often have industry ties as well. The outcry against mandatory arbitration clauses is getting louder. Democratic Senators Patrick Leahy and Russ Feingold recently asked the SEC to make arbitration voluntary for investors. Last month, economist Edward O'Neill and attorney Daniel Solon published a study of arbitration awards. They found that in 1999, 59% of investors won their cases. 5 years later, just 44% won. And those investors recovered just 22 cents for every dollar they lost. But investors may be faring better than these numbers suggest. Linda Feinberg is president of NASD Dispute Resolution. She says these days more cases are settling before they reach arbitration. Stiffer regulations have weeded out the kinds of renegade firms that might have defrauded investors in the past. And Feinberg says the bull market has helped.
The market has been on an extended run-up, and there haven't been any major regulatory issues that have as directly affected investors' pocketbooks. And as a result of that, you see that in the decline in the number of cases that have been brought in the last few years.
Investors who think they got a raw deal in arbitration may not be out of luck. Remember Ernestine Strobel, the Texas senior? Her attorney asked a federal judge to review her $5,000 award. The judge ordered the arbitration panel to come up with a more appropriate amount. So far, the panel has refused. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, video gamers make lots of cash farming out their virtual skills.
A volume of $35 million per month?
Yeah, once. 4 months.
So really, a lot.
Yeah.
But first, let's do the numbers. Trading was a bit slow today as investors held back in anticipation of a new wave of quarterly earnings. The Dow Industrial shrugged up 38 points, 0.25%, to finish the day at 13,649. The Nasdaq sidled up 3 points, 0.1%, to end at 2670. The S&P 500 edged up 1 point, 0.1%, to close at 1531. The greatest love of all had investors singing along. Johnson & Johnson announced plans to buy back $10 billion of its stock. Shares rose 1% on the news. ConocoPhillips said it will snap up $15 billion worth of its own shares. Conoco's stock jumped nearly 3.75%. Aluminum giant Alcoa saw profits slip this quarter. It's down more than 1% in after-hours trading. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Ever hear a song on Marketplace but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to an online store where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee convenes a hearing on the role of the Surgeon General. Three former Surgeons General are scheduled to join the discussion. The National Alliance to End Homelessness continues its annual conference. And San Francisco hosts Major League Baseball's All-Star Game. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. When Tom Stemberg founded the office supply giant Staples back in 1986, he helped pioneer something known as the category killer. That's the nickname for chains like Staples, Best Buy, or Home Depot that dominate specific retail segments. Stemberg's a venture capitalist now, but he's no one-trick pony. The new venture fund he unveiled today will focus on retail startups that are a very long way from the type of store he pioneered. Just about the opposite, in fact. Here's Marketplace's Steve Tripoli.
Tom Stemberg says category killers like his Staples chain aren't where retail's heading anymore.
Today, most of the categories have been killed by very efficient retailers. And the real opportunities are serving consumer niches which are too small to be served by very large stores. So I think there's lots of opportunities to serve customers better and to make a lot of money doing so.
Now Stemberg's at Highland Capital Partners near Boston, and those niche retailers, call them reverse category killers, are where Stemberg's new venture fund is placing $300 million worth of bets. Patty Edwards is an analyst at Wentworth Hauser & Wielitch in Seattle. She says the pendulum's swinging away from the retailing surge that made low prices king.
Now we're having a time period where there's a lot of wealth in the world. We've got the money, and I think that money follows money. There's a lot of money to be made in retail.
And just what are those well-heeled shoppers looking for? Edwards says it's more than just products you won't find at giant retailers, and venture capitalists like Stemberg are tailoring their investments that way.
The experience is a big deal. The small, intimate experience where you actually get help from someone who knows specifically what you're looking at is a big deal. So I think that's part of what they're playing to.
Stemberg's venture money is playing to a diverse set of prospects. There's a gift store chain for people who want to move beyond cards, wine, and flowers, and a holistic pharmacy. And no, you probably won't find a single blue light special in any of these places. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
American business is known for its risk-taking, high risk, high reward, but in some cases, big failure. In the past, there was a wide safety net for individual Americans. They could file for bankruptcy protection under something called Chapter 7, which protected personal assets. Then the government toughened the rules, and now fewer entrepreneurs are able to shield themselves under Chapter 7. Commentator Aparna Mathur says, bad move.
Bill Gates and Michael Dell started out small, operating out of garages and dorm rooms with only an idea to carry them forward. Inspired by success stories like these, every year millions of new businesses start, but nearly half of them fail in the first 5 years. If entrepreneurs know that even if the business fails, their homes and personal assets will be protected, this encourages them to take additional risks. Henry Ford struck gold with his car company, but only after filing for bankruptcy twice. Far more recently, 6 years ago, California entrepreneur Scott Smith was forced to file for personal bankruptcy. His fault? He used the word entrepreneur in his company name. A small business magazine, Entrepreneur Media, had already trademarked the word and sued for $1.5 million. But at that time, under the law, Smith had the right to protect his assets. It was a fresh start with the slate wiped clean. Today, if Smith wanted to file for Chapter 7 bankruptcy, his personal assets would be at stake. That's because under toughened rules, people have to take a means test, and if they earn more than the median income in their state, they're barred from filing for Chapter 7. Instead, he'd most likely file for Chapter 13, a form of bankruptcy that involves reorganization and provides no protection to personal property. That means long repayment periods and no fresh start. My own research shows that the effect of stricter rules is reducing the number of business startups. The American system used to provide entrepreneurs a chance to get back on their feet and to shut down a business if it wasn't doing well. That was one reason America was widely viewed as the most entrepreneurial country in the world. Let's return the rewards to those risk takers.
Aparna Mathur is a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Let us know what you think. Just head over to the marketplace.org site and click on the link that says Contact. You might be surprised to learn that the nation whose people enjoy the most high-speed internet access is not the same country that created the World Wide Web. It's South Korea, which may explain why around 30% of South Koreans are regular players of online video games. For a price, monthly fees, or paying by the hour at internet cafes, they roam virtual worlds, fighting virtual enemies, amassing virtual wealth. But now some of that wealth is spilling over to the real world and spurring enactment of real laws. We sent Rico Galliano to South Korea and, if you will, through the looking glass.
South Koreans love video games. Here's how much. That's 150 people watching a live video game tournament in the city of Seoul. Players sit in futuristic pods playing the sci-fi war game StarCraft. Announcers call the plays as the crowd watches the action on 7 giant overhead plasma screens. The competition is broadcast on 2 Korean TV networks, and the fans cheer their favorite players like they were football stars. The industry is so profitable, the government has a special department to promote and protect it, the Game Industry Division. Kyu Young Kim is in charge of online game policies, and lately he has focused on getting a certain law passed.
In English, it would be called something like the Bill for Promoting the Game Industry.
It's a boring name, but a one-of-a-kind law, the world's first legal crackdown on a form of video game commerce players call gold farming and non-gamers call insane. In a smoky internet cafe in Seoul, a gamer who calls himself Nacho tries to explain gold farming to me. He sits at a beat-up PC playing the online swords and sorcery game Lineage 2. With a mouse, he guides his little dwarf character through a medieval landscape. Most of the creatures he passes, scary orcs, half-nude elves, are controlled by other players. He heads into a dungeon.
This place we're going to? I'm guessing there will probably be a lot of gold farmers there.
Why?
Because there's a lot of good items here.
By good items, Nacho means virtual magic swords, or baby dragons, or lots of virtual gold. These things can make a player's character more powerful. Gold farmers are players who figure out when and where these items appear, and then spend time, lots of time, hoarding them.
You see the same game character in the same spot, doing the same hunting for the same item for 2, 3, 4 days, even up to a month. That's a gold farmer.
They're not playing for fun. They're playing for cash. Because the farmers can sell this virtual stuff to other players for real money. The South Korean government estimates game item trade is a billion-dollar industry in Asia, enough to inspire some gold farmers in China to open sweatshops, paying workers low hourly wages to harvest items. And farmers aren't the only ones who profit.
My name's Hyungshin Park. I've worked at ItemBay since 2002.
ItemBay.com was the first so-called mediating site in South Korea. It's the eBay of game item trade. Gamers post their virtual scepters and laser rifles for others to buy. ItemBay gets a 5% transaction fee.
We get roughly 50,000 transactions every month, and $35 million is the amount that's traded on the website.
A volume of $35 million per month?
Yeah, per month.
So really a lot.
Yeah.
Sites like ItemBay love gold farmers. Farmers post lots of items for sale, so ItemBay earns lots of fees. But the government's Kyu Young Kim says for companies that make online games, farmers can be costly pests.
Some gold farmers work in groups. They use 100 computers at once and hack into the software of the games in order to generate and grab more items. So the software companies try to prevent this kind of hacking, and the cost to maintain security keeps going up.
What's more, gold farmers supply rich players with such powerful items, it can ruin a game. Poorer players can't compete. Some quit playing, and the game makers lose money. Which brings us back to the bill for promoting the game industry. The government's first draft of the bill fell like a mighty hammer on mediating websites like ItemBay. It seemed to outlaw item trading, even between casual individual gamers. ItemBay responded by forming the Digital Asset Protection Association, a lobbying group of websites threatened by the bill. And after much deliberation, in the 2007th year after Christ, the final bill passed into law. And it's actually pretty straightforward. Use hacking software or engage in bulk item trade, and you can be fined up to $50,000 and jailed up to 5 years. Otherwise, individual small-time gold farmers are free to harvest. Still, it all begs an obvious question, which I pose to ItemBay's Hyungshin Park.
Do you ever stop and think, there's all this money and all this time and effort, and now laws and trading associations being built up over these items that don't exist?
I would say never.
In Seoul, Korea, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, looks like the oldest futures exchange is now about to become the biggest. The Chicago Board of Trade was established in 1848. In a deal announced today, it'll be acquired by its longtime rival, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. The deal was sealed after CBOT investors were offered a price they could live with, almost $12 billion. That price beat out an $11.8 billion offer from the Intercontinental Exchange. The bids were close, but ICE's numbers just weren't enough to compete with the $1 billion in cash the Merck had on hand to sweeten the deal. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow skated up 38 points, a quarter percent. The Nasdaq rose 3 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 moseyed up 1 point, also 0.1%. Our producers include Megan Larson and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time, minor league baseball players can struggle hard to hit it big.
Everybody thinks, oh, they're major league baseball players, you know, they make the big bucks, but they don't at this level. They have to pay their dues.
I'm Bob Moon. Please join Kai back here again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.